They set out to kill him, and they did it. And it's been documented.
So we say, we always say to Black Panther Party that they can do anything they want to us. We might not be back.
This scene alone might be why you should really, really buy or rent this movie, The Weather Underground. Just seeing the assassination and the leftover.
In Chicago today, two Black Panthers were killed as police raided a Panther stronghold.
Police arrived at Fred Hampton's West Side apartment at 4:45 this morning. They had a search warrant authorizing them to look for illegal weapons. The state's attorney's office says that Hampton and another man were killed in the 15-minute gun battle which followed.
The pigs murdered our deputy chairman Fred Hampton while he lay in bed. Their lies, their arguing to the people can't bear up to the evidence that we have that they murdered our deputy chairman in cold blood as he lay in his bed asleep.
The Panther Party organized tours of the apartment that they were in when they were murdered. And I went with a group of people from the SDS national office, which was a couple of blocks away.
Don't touch nothing, don't move nothing, because we want to keep everything just the way it is.
It was a scene of carnage. It was a scene of war. You see this door ridden with bullets, not little bullet holes, but shattered.
The room where the first brother, Mark Clark, was murdered at.
You walk through a living room into the bedroom, and there's a mattress soaked in his blood, red blood down the floor.
Anyone who went through that apartment and examined the evidence that was remaining there could come to only one conclusion, and that is that Fred Hampton, 21 years old, and a member of a militant, well-known militant group, was murdered in his bed, probably as he lay asleep.
This blatant act of legitimatized murder strips all credibility from law enforcement. In the context of other acts against militant blacks in recent months, it suggests an official policy of systematic repression.
We felt that the murder of Fred required us to be more grave, more serious, more determined to raise the stakes. And not just be the white people who wrung their hands when black people were being murdered.
It's 2.5 weeks since Fred Hampton was murdered by the pigs who own this city. And for people to be able to enjoy Christmas time in this country without remembering and without making a choice about the struggle that's going on in the world, without taking action about a blatant murder that takes place in the city against a revolutionary black leader, is an obscenity.
When Fred was killed, I felt that this was the true kind of exposure of state power. This was really the way America was. It was willing to kill and murder, not just thousands of miles away, but right on the west side of Chicago, if it felt its power slipping at all. The mood was a mood that kind of ricocheted between determination and despair. There was a real sense that things were going to get pretty bad, and that the killing of Fred was emblematic of things getting pretty bad, and that we none of us imagined that we were going to live through it. We all felt that we were kind of biting our lip and getting ready for a serious confrontation.
December 1969, the month that Fred Hampton was killed, was a moment of intense violence and despair in America. For many young people, the hope and idealism of the 60s died that month at the Altamont Speedway in California. A concert that was supposed to have been the West Coast version of Woodstock turned into a nightmare of bad drugs and violence. The concert fell apart when the Hells Angels killed a man in front of the stage as the Rolling Stones played. That same month, Charles Manson and his followers were a top news story. They too signaled the end of the 60s and were the ugliest possible expression of the zeitgeist. Acid-crazed hippies committing a string of random violent murders.
Acid-crazed hippies!
And in the same month, Life magazine published these photographs, taken while American soldiers massacred hundreds of unarmed Vietnamese civilians in the village of My Lai.
Okay, which is worse? Acid-crazed hippies!
It was the first time that many Americans had seen such disturbing images of the war.
The Vietnam War had made us crazy. It was sort of a mass mania driven by the United States bombing of Vietnam, among other things. And it just fed on itself. And, you know, when you feel that you have right on your side, you can do some horrific things.
We figured out how to use guns and how to use bombs. I mean, we taught ourselves, we trained ourselves how to do it. At the same time, the organization was unable to resolve the question of how militant, how far would we go. Some people felt, literally, that the bigger the mess we could make, the better. That is, that whatever it cost, whatever, you know, destructive kinds of activity we could do against the U.S. government, the better.
At that point in our thinking, there were no innocent Americans, at least not among the white ones. They all played some part in the atrocities of Vietnam, if only the passive roles of ignorance, acquiescence, and acceptance of privilege. All guilty. All Americans were legitimate targets for attack. We wanted this country to taste a tiny bit of what it had been dishing out. Just like the passive Americans we derided, I acquiesced to this terrible, demented logic. Not only was I willing to take the risks and suffer the consequences, but more importantly, I was overwhelmed by hate. I cherished my hate as a badge of moral superiority.
The townhouse was part of a small autonomous group in New York City that was being led by Terry Robbins.
Terry, more than probably anyone else, represented the view that it was too late for any kind of reconciliation inside this country, and that the best that we could do was to bring about a catastrophic series of actions that would get the attention of the world.
The group that was led by Terry in that house on West 11th Street was building the bomb. They had decided to set off the bomb at a non-commissioned officer's dance at Fort Dix. The idea being that there are no innocent in this war of aggression.
What we wanted to do here was deliver the most horrific hit that the United States government had ever suffered on its territory. We wanted to light it up. Our slogan was bring the war home, and we really wanted to give the United States and the rest of the world a sense that this country was going to be completely unlivable if the United States continued in Vietnam. And that was the goal of this group.
This is the part where they decided they were going
to
build bombs.
What has
to
be said at is that they brought themselves, they were not brought, they brought themselves to that point. To the point at which they were ready to be mass murderers. This is mass murder we're talking about. They came to this conclusion, which is the conclusion that was come to by all the great killers. whether Hitler or Stalin or Mao, that they have a grand project for the transformation and purification of the world. And in the face of that project, ordinary life is dispensable. They joined that tradition.
On March 6, 1970, as the weatherman group on West 11th Street put the final touches on the bomb, there was a short circuit in the wiring, and the device accidentally exploded.
Oops.
New York's Greenwich Village was destroyed by three explosions, which killed at least three people.
The police still only know a part of the story. What they still have to find out is a good deal more about the extent of the bomb plot and the extent to which the student protesters of the 60s have turned into more serious revolutionaries using far more lethal weapons.
One body was identified as that of SDS member Theodore Gold. The second dead man has not yet been identified. A third victim was identified as 28-year-old Diana Houghton, a member of the SDS Weatherman faction. She was the daughter of one of the richest men in the small town of Dwight, Illinois.
When he heard the news of his daughter's death, James Houghton, a local banker and former Republican member of the Illinois House, cut short a vacation in London and hurried home.
I've been asked how I would advise other parents, and I've answered that I have no advice at all. I wouldn't know how to advise myself. I'm looking for guidelines myself from somebody else.
Let's take a little pause here for a second. You're away on business, and you find out that your daughter, college-age daughter, has been killed building a bomb in protest and revolt against the United States government. What the fuck does go through your head? I mean, really, it's time to question your ability as a parent and the world that you brought a child into. So when they ask me, are you going to have kids? I say, and bring them into this world? And I put it back on them. Because it is our world, and until we make it a better place, I don't think I'm going to be the one inviting more kids into it. But that's just a sidebar. Let's get back to the movie.
I was in Denver. We had a collective there. I heard something on a radio. We were actually driving to the mountains to do target practice. I heard something on the radio about, and it was statically, about somebody Gold was killed in an explosion in New York City.
Okay, her
later
name is
I
Diana
got a call.
Otten, O-U-G-H-T-O-N.
They're not people. And I would say that that's the one point in my life where I was overwhelmed by the heaviness of it. That was a really difficult loss.
When the townhouse went up, it was at that point that the FBI knew that it was in a battle and that these were truly committed revolutionaries who planned on doing a lot more to achieve the violent overthrow of this government than just talking about it. These weathermen people were actually randomly bombing and intended to kill people. At that point, pressure came all the way from the White House to catch these people. It was very, very high pressure.
When this explosion happened, a group of us disappeared from sight, and that was really the official beginning of what came to be called the Weather Underground.
Anyone who does have any information on where these people are located
should immediately contact the FBI.
I cut my hair. That was hard for me. I had long hair down to my waist for a lot of years. And so preparing to go underground, I cut my hair off. And I went back to say goodbye to my family on the farm. My family's a very strong, cohesive, extended Jewish family. And they were just hurt and confused. I remember feeling that unless I really made a break with my family, I wasn't going to be able to be free to do what I'd have to do as a revolutionary. It was a lot of hurt to my family, my parents. But I was going to do it. I just wasn't going to let anything hold me back.
I knew we were going underground, but of course I didn't know how precipitously it would happen. My parents weren't political. They didn't have any way in which to put that into a framework. But I took a last trip to visit them, and I didn't want to scare them more than they were already worried, but I did want them to think back and remember what I said, that I didn't want to hurt them and that I loved them. So I, you know, have a vivid memory of saying goodbye to them at the airport and walking away and turning around and looking at them waving at me and knowing that I wasn't going to see them again.
Bye, Mom. Bye, Dad. Woo.
Shortly after the townhouse explosion, the leaders of the Weather Underground gathered at a house on the coast of Northern California to figure out what had gone wrong.
We took a deep, deep breath and a big step back from the precipice. There was a huge debate about what had happened, and the conclusion that the majority of us came to was that a terrible error had been made, that it was definitely wrong to unleash indiscriminate violence against ordinary people, that that was actually terrorism.
I wasn't in the leadership. You know, I wasn't making decisions, but I still feel responsible because I didn't say at any point, wait a second. You know, if we're going to talk about waging war against, bring the war home, wage war against in the belly of the mother country and all that stuff, we better know what we're talking about before we start actually taking actions. And, you know, I regret that to this day.
We were very careful from the moment of the townhouse on to be sure we weren't going to hurt anybody. And we never did hurt anybody. Whenever we put a bomb in a public space, we had figured out all kinds of ways to put checks and balances on the thing and also to get people away from it. And we were remarkably successful.
Our goal was to not hurt any people, and a lot of work went into that. But we wanted to pick targets that show to the public who was responsible for what was really going on.
During the early 1970s, there was a strong radical prison movement in the United States.
We are men! We are not beasts, and we do not intend to be driven or beaten as such. The entire prison populace has set forth to change forever the ruthless brutalization and disregard for the lives of the prisoners here and throughout the United States.
One of the prison movement's leaders was George Jackson. He had become famous after publishing a bestseller. In August 1971, Jackson was killed by guards at San Quentin during an escape attempt.
Our witnesses say that George Jackson was shot in the leg, apparently went down, got up, and was running in a cross position, and was shot again.
They say that George ran for the gate with a gun in his hand. That sounds a lot like...
Let's say anything.
We were not unprepared for this crisis. We'd been watching the prison scene closely, after all, and had often discussed potential targets. The State Corrections Department had a suite of offices in the Ferry Building at the edge of downtown in San Francisco. The gray prison bureaucracy was usually both anonymous and unaccountable. Flushing them out and humiliating them in their fancy digs was a proper step towards redress. We started moving people and supplies into a motel on Lombard Street on Thursday evening. Arrivals and departures from the motel were tightly rationed. We didn't want it to look like a dope dealer had set up shop. Stanley and I started working on the wiring that first night. Zeke was holed up somewhere, working on the communique, which we were all dying to see. We had the thing pretty well built, and were testing the connections by mid-morning Friday.
Tap, 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 tap. They're making a communique. Here it comes.
Nick slid the box into the airline bag, then zippered the bag shut and hung it on my shoulder. Hugs and kisses all around and out the door into the bright California sun. All of the safeguards in the world could not take the fear out of the Enterprise from this point on. Up the parcel goes, my hands to his, into the hole. One last moment of serious vulnerability. Stepping back into the main hall. All clear. Leave in opposite directions. Don't walk too fast. It's 2:30. 9.5 hours to go. We did it.
The bomb is placed in the Ferry Building, San Francisco.
San Francisco Chronicle, August 28, 1971. The call from the young man was made to Helen Garrick, switchboard operator at the Chronicle. She kept notes on what the caller said. Quote, "There's a bomb in the Ferry Building. It will go off in 15 minutes. They're doing this in defense of Jackson. Be sure to have the Harbor Police and the City Police clear the area."
The Underground Weatherman Organization claimed responsibility for the San Francisco and Sacramento bombings, saying they were, I quote, "in outraged response to the assassination of Soledad brother George Jackson."
The bombings came just hours before Jackson's funeral at this Episcopal church in the poor black section of Oakland.
To the Jackson family.
This is the 12th communication from the Weather Underground. The history of black people in this country has been one of passionate resistance to the slave masters. All too often, they have had to wage that fight alone. Black and brown people inside the jails are doing all they can. Must they fight alone even now? White people on the outside have a deep responsibility to enter the battle at every level. We view our action as simply a first expression of our love and respect for George Jackson and the warriors of San Quentin.
A lot of imagery here, and a lot of violence, and some captions I need to read to you. In May 1970, the Weather Underground bombs the National Guard headquarters in response to the Kent State killings. June 9th, 1970, New York City Police Department headquarters, in response to a police repression, is bombed. July 16, 1970,
in Washington, today
Presidio Army Base San Francisco,
in which an organization
to mark the 11th anniversary of the Cuban Revolution.
Bombed the Capitol yesterday.
February 28, 1971, U.S. Capitol is bombed to protest the invasion of Laos.
We have attacked the Capitol because it is a monument to U.S. domination over the planet.
We didn't do it, but we dug it. The people who did the Capitol bombing were the Weather Underground. They bombed the Capitol to bring a smile and a wink to all the kids who hate the American government.
Harvard Center for International Affairs is bombed to protest the war in Vietnam, October 8, 1970. September 17, 1971, New York Department of Corrections is bombed to protest the killing of 29 inmates at Attica State Prison.
There are sick minds, apparently, in this
country. This is Walter Mondale.
That violence can be used to bring about social reform or change national policy. It clearly can't, and moreover, these kinds of insane efforts hurt, not help.
When weather first went underground in 70, the conventional wisdom that we would be rounded up within a year. You don't remember the 50s. I grew up in the 50s. Every TV program, the police or the FBI always got their man. In fact, I think there was a movie code. You couldn't show people getting away with crime. So there was a psyche in the population that it was impossible to defy the FBI. Everybody on the left said, no, this is only going to last for a few months.
Underground is sort of a state of information control rather than a place. It means having a lot of control about who knows what, about who you are, and where you are. So you don't have a phone to use. My phone calls are really controlled. I didn't hang out in places where a lot of people from my past were going to recognize me.
It's a parallel universe. I mean, the number of times that I would run into people who should have recognized me, people who asked around me, is how would they recognize you? You were underground. So you couldn't possibly be walking out of that theater because you're not here. You're invisible.
That's right, you're invisible. You're underground.
There was a leadership group, which was the Weather Bureau, that circulated around the country and would visit various collectives. I was in one of the groups. So they would visit us occasionally. I didn't know exactly what was happening in all the other areas of the country because we had a need-to-know principle, right? If you didn't have to know it, you didn't know it, and you didn't ask.
Feel like your life is going nowhere. Feel like your life is going nowhere. Feel like your life is going nowhere. Feel like your life is going nowhere.
Tonight, American and South Vietnamese will attack the headquarters of the entire communist military operation.
As President Nixon continued to widen the Vietnam War, American society grew more and more polarized.
I deserve to go to hell. Oh God, I'm upset.
For a time, the Weather Underground seemed to have its finger on the pulse of the growing counterculture. For many young people, the Weather Underground had become larger-than-life figures, outlaws in the tradition of Bonnie and Clyde or Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Their successful actions only added to the mystique.
I've probably pushed my nervous system as much as any human being living. I've taken LSD over 500 times.
One of the group's most high-profile actions was helping the counterculture hero Timothy Leary escape from a California prison.
Did he say he'd done acid 500 times?
Leary was serving a 10-year prison sentence for possession of several joints. The Weather Underground was paid $20,000 for the job.
This group, the Brotherhood of Eternal Love, do you know who they are? They gave us a certain amount of money to break Leary out of jail and get him out of the country. They're a drug group, mainly LSD.
Is this the most ridiculous thing ever? Timothy Leary in jail on possession of two joints.
Black Panther leader Ellery Cleaver said that LSD advocate Timothy Leary, who escaped from a California prison last month, has joined forces with him in Algeria.
Algeria?
I escaped with the help of the Weathermen Underground. No. 25 of their crack underground operators came to California for 6 weeks before my escape. And it was a very complicated operation. They not only helped us escape, they spirited us to several of their underground stations with great efficiency. We want to tell the people of the United States the Third World War has begun. Join us in the fight for freedom because we are everywhere and we're happy and we're free and we want to make the world free.
This is the fifth communication from the Weatherman Underground. Rosemary and Tim are free and high. We are building a culture and a society that can resist genocide. It is a culture of total resistance to mind-controlling maniacs. A culture of high-energy sisters getting it on. Of hippie acid smiles and communes and freedom to be the farthest out people we can be.
Maniacal mind controllers are out to get you.
Now we are everywhere, and next week, families and tribes will attack the enemy around the country.
Attack, attack, attack.
We are not just attacking targets. We are bringing a pitiful, helpless giant to its knees. Guard your planes. Guard your colleges. Guard your banks. Guard your children. Guard your doors.
Can you verify that the voice is that of Bernadine Dorn?
The voice in my head is my own.
Yes, I'm her sister, and I'll verify that it's her voice.
What is your name?
Jennifer.
How do you feel about what your sister is advocating?
I think it's right on. I think she's far out, and all weathermen are far out.
Could you explain that?
Yeah, would you explain far out for us, please?
They're forced to be outlaws by the way the society is run, and we think they're great.
Yeah. Yeah, my sister's cool. She's part of the underground.
We're in Sausalito at the houseboat. It's right on the other side of the Golden Gate Bridge from San Francisco. And we lived here when we first went underground.
Really odd place to be underground. You have no escape routes. You're on a pier.
Makes no sense at all to me. I was on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. There were pictures everywhere and rewards everywhere and indictments falling from the sky. It was much less built up than this. For us, it was perfect. There were dropouts from all walks of life. Gay people fleeing Iowa, people fleeing the Midwest and the draft. So there was a lot of outlaw culture.
Damn,
because
hippie outlaws.
Of the way that this country is falling apart, more and more young people are living in communal situations. More and more young people are beginning to fight the government on various levels. And so there's a huge mass of people that people who are underground fugitives can move amongst and have protection from and be with.
Right, they're all living together.
Weathermen were extremely bright. Many of them had access to fairly substantial amounts of money, which is the key to staying underground. We didn't get them, but we came close. It was frustrating when you wanted to catch these people as much as we did.
Sucking on my titties like you wanted me.
You were
going to
catch these people in the standard FBI approach of surveilling the house the night before Grandma's 50th wedding anniversary. So the fugitive comes walking in with a gift. Bang, you got him. It wasn't going to work that way. The way that we decided to do was to basically go underground, essentially the same way they did, and use some investigative techniques which were very tried and true in the National Security Division.
They did break into people's apartments and steal things, did try to plant divisive stories among people who were working in the peace movement and
those bastards trying to divide up the peace movement.
And I had a whole strategy that included beating people up and dangling people out of windows, and you know, it was not just light.
I know people who have liberal political tendencies would say it's terrible. People who don't would say that
You know, if you're not doing anything wrong, nothing wrong's going to happen, anything bad's going to happen to you.
In the early 1970s, a group of radicals calling itself the Citizens Commission to Investigate the FBI broke into an FBI field office in Media, Pennsylvania, and made off with several boxes of files. The documents, which were leaked anonymously to the press, revealed the existence of COINTELPRO, a secret FBI program to destroy a wide range of groups that opposed the U.S. government.
The word COINTELPRO. It's the FBI doing investigations on its own people in America. And they're tracking you down, they're going to infiltrate your group, and then they're going to bust you. It's not a fucking
game. The Black Panthers, the anti-war movement, even Martin Luther King.
How did all this information come about? It was stolen by revolutionaries.
By the early 1970s, COINTELPRO had been largely effective.
The movement began to devour itself. There was the absence of all the things that made the movement so powerful. Absence of trust, absence of love, absence of a sense of humor, absence of commitment, absence of this communal, we're all in this together. All that stuff seemed to have been blown apart.
In the early 70s, the psychic stress, the psychic upheaval was so intense, and the loss of ideological underpinnings and clarity about the world is so severe that many people who had come out of the New Left were in retreat.
I remember sitting on a park bench reading the newspaper, and I thought to myself, here I am sitting on a park bench doing absolutely nothing when I had been the chairman of the largest national anti-war organization in the United States, a student anti-war organization in the United States. I thought to myself, what a waste, what am I doing here?
What am I doing here, sitting on this park bench?
I thought we were being reduced to a group that just put a bomb here, and then a few months later put a bomb here, and then put a bomb there. That seemed to me to be sort of played out. It was how much further could we go with that? And we were increasingly being thought of sort of an isolated cult. I was feeling lonely and alienated, and I missed my girlfriend, and I just wasn't having a very good time. And the combination of the two, one day I just walked out.
Even revolutionaries get burnt out. How about that?
During the mid-1970s, as the black movement and the anti-war movement faded, the left branched off into a wide range of organizations and causes.
I don't remember much interest among people I knew in what the Weathermen were doing. I was around a lot of students, and there was a lot of interest in the women's movement. I mean, that had a presence, and it was certainly a lot of opposition to the war. But I don't remember anybody ever talking about the Weathermen. By the mid-70s, the Weather Underground was a kind of reverberation in time, kind of golden oldie.
We're five people from the Weather Underground organization. We're in a house, you could call it a safe house. We're here with a group of filmmakers, and together we're going to make a film.
Here we are, the windows are boarded up. It's very awkward. And we are willing to take the risk of doing this because it seemed like We could speak to a lot of people, and we do want to do that.
How many people are in your organization?
Organization relative to the task to be done. And we can't discuss exactly the size. We're small, but we don't feel weak. We want to make a revolution. We think there has to be a revolution.
From the underground, that
yes. Message today, there must be a revolution.
Thank you, Kill Radio listeners, for staying tuned to this beautiful rebroadcast. Have a cinema morning past. You're listening to Weather Underground.
Make the changes.
Kill Radio.
Live well. Don't
O-R-G.
Destroy your neighbors. Don't destroy the other people on the other side of the world that you don't know, and consider the others. They are not others, by the way. They are people just like you and me, who've grown up with parents just like you and I did, and are going to have kids and live their lives and do what they want to do. What are you going to do about it? Well, yeah. Anyway, that song, that techno song back there, was Golden Boy with Miss Kitten. I hear Miss Kitten's in town. Might have been last night, but, you know, I love when DJs do that shit. Oh, yeah, last night you missed the best show in the fucking world ever, dude. You can't even believe it's over. Anyway. Back to the movie. Just after this. And here's my favorite reason. I think. Or here's one of those things. What do you do? What do you do? What do you do? That's not an answer. Let's see if I can cue this up real quick. You can't give me that answer. You gotta give me a real answer. Are you set? Let's try this. Cinema Mornings with Cody. Back to the Weather Underground.
Radical left-wing group, the Weatherman, has claimed responsibility for yesterday's dynamiting of a statue of a Chicago policeman. The group promises more attacks on the establishment around the entire country starting next week. The medium for this message was a tape recording, reputedly by the fugitive Weatherman leader, Bernadine Dorn.
The group said that it planted the bomb to commemorate the one-year anniversary of the military overthrow of the Allende government in Chile.
There are 20 to 30 people in the group. We know who they are, and there are federal warrants out on, I believe, 12 of them.
A dynamite explosion last night heavily damaged one floor of the Gulf Oil Corporation's Pittsburgh headquarters. No one was hurt. A radical group called the Weather Underground said it set the blast in retaliation for Gulf's policies in Portuguese Angola in Africa.
Why? Because we're mad. Mad, I tell ya. May 18th, 1973.
We felt that more and more people would
Weather be Underground bombs, attracted the 103rd Precinct
to
the police department in New York
violence of the Weather
for
Underground
killing a 10-year-old black youth.
What I began to discover was that Americans are taught again and again from a very early age that the only violence, that all violence which is not sanctioned by the government is either criminal or mentally ill. And so our violence was categorized as that, criminal and mentally ill. Violence didn't work.
March 6th.
And
1974, Department of Health and Welfare, San Francisco is bombed to protest the forced sterilization of poor women. May 31st the same year, Office of the State Attorney General of California is bombed in response to killing of six Symbionese Liberation Army members.
They put them in jail. Yeah.
The State Department, January 28th, in protest of the war in Vietnam.
A quarter century of American involvement in South Vietnam is over.
These are tonight's headlines. South Vietnam surrenders and the communists occupy Saigon. We have dramatic film of the evacuation of Americans and Vietnamese from Saigon.
The war in Vietnam was the most visible and the most palpable and the most dramatic expression of what we were opposed to. And so our unity was based on throwing our bodies into combat against the war in Vietnam. When the war in Vietnam ended, all of that unity began to unravel.
A lot of us, with the end of the war in 75, began to come up with the idea that we should come up, that it was pointless to stay underground.
It wasn't going to be as dramatic after the Vietnam War ended in 75, and there were increasing struggles about what was wrong with our direction, and I think that happened. The whole left was challenged at the end of the Vietnam War.
The end happened because most all leftist political organizations, when they reach the point of irrelevancy, turn in on themselves, and kill each other. And that's approximately what happened.
The organization was coming apart through a variety of means, people deciding to turn themselves in, a great deal of criticism of us, of me, for the failures and weaknesses in our leadership.
People knew each other's whereabouts on a need-to-know basis.
What would you do if the war was over?
Toward the end, that became more and more restricted.
Go become a consumer?
More and more.
Have kids?
Freaked out.
Yeah.
Paranoid, I would
right.
say, to some extent. And so I had no way. I wasn't living in a collective.
Turn yourself in?
I was living on my own.
That's brainy.
And what I had as a connection was meeting to meeting. We're going to meet at such and such a place at such and such a time. I raised the criticisms in a particularly sharp way at a meeting with some people in leadership, and they didn't show up for the next meeting, and then I didn't have any way to get in touch with them anymore. So it was over for me.
Yeah. If you don't come to the meetings, how are you going to know when the next meeting is? Well, shit. That's the nature of secret societies, though. You're either in or you're not.
October 19th, 1977. Dear Dad, hello from the other side of the shadows. I don't mean to shock you, but I've been contemplating writing to you for a long time. First, the good news, which is you have a second grandson. He had a good birth, no drugs, no problems, and his mom is okay, too.
He doesn't have a name, but he's born.
I've been working when I can, which is not full-time and not nearly enough to support us. Not only do I lack skills and qualifications, I also lack the references and work record fitting my age, all of which become more important with this extreme unemployment. Right now, it's hard to get a job pushing a broom if you can't prove you've been doing it for 10 years. Often I wake up and find it completely inexplicable how and why I am where I am today and disconnected from my family. As I know you won't be out here for a while, I'm finding an address where you can write me directly. Please send me your advice or reflections on what I should do.
Mark Rudd, the fugitive radical, turned himself in today to authorities in New York City after years of hiding. He was a leader of the Weather Underground back in the 60s, but he's 30 years old now, and the world has changed.
Today, Rudge came out of hiding and walked into the office of the District Attorney of New York County to give himself up. Rudd didn't say why he gave himself up, but his father said this. He's 30 years old. You get to be too old to be a revolutionary. You have to start something else.
Even though the organization had ended and we really didn't have a...
That's pretty fucked up. Hold on. Let's talk about that for a second. Somehow, you automatically grow older and you join the establishment. It's just somehow obvious that you're going to flip and become a sellout. It's automatic to your parents.
Oh yeah, well that happened to us.
Mark Rudd led the revolution. He led this group. And what happens?
Yeah, well, the war's over, I gotta turn myself in.
But nothing had changed. Sure, the war was over and we were leaving Vietnam, but the industrial complex still lived. The military still fought and had its secret wars here and there. Anyway, that's enough of my sidebar. Back to the movie.
Political reason for staying underground. I found the idea of turning myself in revolting. And I had a baby. We had a new baby. And we immersed ourselves in a whole new life with parents and children. And moved to the East Coast and sort of started over. And Zaid was getting old enough so that it was obviously becoming... complicated to never have anybody know where we lived and never have anybody come over to our house. So I came to that decision in the summer of 80, finally. And once I made the decision, it was just a matter of holding my nose and going through with the surrender.
Bernardine Dorn, the former anti-war leader and student radical, surrendered today in Chicago.
Rebellion is inevitable and continuous. Resistance by every means necessary is happening and will continue to happen within the United States as well as around the world, and I remain committed to the struggle ahead.
By the end of the 70s, almost all of the members of the Weather Underground had turned themselves in. Few ended up going to prison. Ironically, the government was forced to drop most of the charges against them when it became clear how much the FBI had broken the law in pursuing the group.
Remember, J. Edgar Hoover was still around, and he was still chasing people like...
As the 70s drew to a close, America seemed to be falling apart. Watergate, Vietnam, and recession had sapped the country's confidence. Most Americans seemed to want to put the trauma of the previous decade behind them.
Here a lot in the last 30 years. Nice little tree-lined street, pretty buildings. And never really gets much easier. If you think that you have the moral high ground, that's a very dangerous position and you can do some really dreadful things. You see it with terrorists these days, you know, who think that, well, maybe Allah's on their side or history's on their side or whatever. They can do some things that are just completely unconscionable, that can blow up the World Trade Center, you know, they can do, they can just do horrible, horrible things, the Oklahoma City bombing. I'm sure that guy felt it, that he was on the side of right. You know, there may be a handful of people who agreed with him, so that is a dangerous ethical position that we fell into, that was caused, I think, a lot by the Vietnam War. I think that the Vietnam War made us all a little crazy. It's the only way I can explain it.
When I was in prison, I'd been in prison for about 2 years, and I was put in isolation. And I wrote a letter to my father, and I said, either I'm really a great optimist and have just oceans of hope and joy, or I'm really stupid and too dumb to know what's happening to me. And I still feel that sometimes, because most of the movement that was committed to and really thought a revolution was going to happen in the late 60s, early 70s, has fallen by the wayside and said, oh, it's going to be eons and, you know, it's not going to happen, whatever. Not most, but a lot of people. I still have hope. I don't think we're going to have a revolution in 5 years like I did in 1970. But I definitely think that people never stop struggling and never stop waiting for the moment when they can change the things that make their lives unlivable.
I would do it again. I'd like to do it better, differently, smarter, but in a revolutionary context, if I didn't have my old parents and my young kid, I would certainly do it again. I would certainly want to be part of an emerging revolution again. It was a precious, precious opportunity. And I think we came close. I mean, I think the world came close to seeing those major changes, and I think that that makes a difference in terms of the ability of movements for change to emerge in the future. The fact that there's a history of resistance, there's a history of white people's participation in resistance, I think makes a difference to the ability of that kind of resistance to emerge again.
Do you think it will?
I think it already is.
Why have you been so reluctant to talk about your own experiences?
My mixed feelings. My feelings of guilt and shame. These are things that I am not proud of. I find it hard to speak publicly about them, you know, and to tease out what was right from what was wrong. I think that part of the Weatherman phenomenon that was right was our understanding of what the position of the United States is in the world. It was this knowledge that we just couldn't handle. It was too big. We didn't know what to do. In a way, I still don't know what to do with this knowledge. I don't know what needs to be done now. And it's still eating away at me, just as it did 30 years ago.
Naomi Jaffe lives in Albany, New York.
She's an activist for an anti-racist group and executive director of a group called Holding Our Own, a local women's co-op. David Gilbert joined the Black Liberation Army, was involved in an armored car robbery that killed two policemen and a security guard in 1981, and serves a 75-year term at Attica State Prison. Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn are married and live in Chicago. He's an author and professor of education at the University of Illinois. She teaches at Northwestern Law School and is director of Children and Family Justice Center. Mark Rudd, leader of the Weather Underground, lives in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and teaches math at TVI Community College. Laura Whitehorn joined the Underground Armed Resistance and was arrested in 1985 after a string of bombings against including one at the Capitol in Washington, D.C. She served 14 years in prison and now lives in New York City and is an activist in many progressive causes. Brian Flanagan owns a bar in New York, and he recently won $23,000 on Jeopardy. The Weather Underground movement may have been a spot in the history of America, but I think that the revolutionary attitudes are still there, and they're very important. Kill Radio exists as one of those outgrowths. While we don't necessarily condone or endorse violence against the state or against any person, we do understand that protest, resistance, alternative thinking are parts of the progressive cause. You've been listening to Cinema Mornings with Cody Wyoming. This show is produced solely by Cody Wyoming himself. Opinions expressed here are those of myself and are not attributable to any other person, group, or cause, although they may be shared by those people, groups, and causes. This movie is The Weather Underground, produced by people out of San Francisco. Money from BAVAC, FAF, other groups. It's available on DVD, VHS, wherever you get those things. I assume that you're a underground natural freak of yourself, and therefore do have access to these things. Should probably try a couple tunes. Could use a caller or two to bounce some more ideas off of. What do you think about? What do you think about this whole thing about building bombs and blowing up the police department and direct response to actions downtown or across town or whatever? How long are you willing to live on the run? How long are you willing to be underground? What are the consequences of direct violence? Are you a peaceful protester? Are you the one who goes out and chants and screams and is seen in the streets? There was a moment back there when Richard Nixon said, "These protests will not deter me. They mean nothing to me." And I think I had heard that before. And then, what do we get? 43 GWB said the same thing a little over a year ago. Really made me wonder. Did he make that up himself? And what is it about having this attitude that says, I am not willing to listen to anybody, dissenters, others mean nothing to me. They will not sway my determination to go and kill and annihilate people on the other side of the earth
in your name. You cannot talk me down from this. And that stubborn attitude is something that I rather resent from an elected representative of the people. Now, mind you, I use elected and representative and people loosely, but folks, we're on the verge of a new election. I said it earlier, I really don't know that electing John Kerry is going to change anything. When we talk about change in politics, you generally have a long glacial change. We could be, who knows, on the verge of something. He's got a lot of talk and, you know, some promises he's made, so maybe that's in there, but you let me know. Phone 213-252-0998. We got a few more minutes. I don't see Shannon, but I do expect her to come in and answer your question. And thank you for listening to Cinema Mornings on a Friday on Kill Radio. La Femme Tequila is next with some classy ladies of rock and roll to soothe your soul. You've been listening to The Weather Underground. Please don't call. Also available on radioforall.net with random intrusions and updates. Check them out. Listeners of the Kill Radio stream, thank you for listening. Cody Wyoming is out. I hope that this was a enlightening, refreshing revisit to an earlier Cinema Mornings, and you were not disappointed. Back next week with something even more interesting. Watch out for Sonic Outlaws coming soon to a internet stream near you. This has been Cinema Mornings on Kill Radio.